The United States has also relied on a set of obscure security cooperation authorities that The Intercept has previously investigated, including an expose earlier this year that revealed the existence of unreported U.S. counterterrorism efforts in Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen. A Bryce document, so-called 127E programs, known by their legal designation in those countries, and 12 others, including Afghanistan, Cameroon, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Mauritania, Niger, Nigeria, Somalia, and Tunisia, as well as a country in the Asia-Pacific region that has not yet been publicly identified. The 127E authority, which allows U.S. commandos to employ local surrogates on U.S.-directed missions targeting U.S. enemies to achieve U.S. aims, is just one of the three low-profile efforts analyzed in the Brennan Center report. Another 10 U.S. Code 333, often referred to as the Global Train and Equip Authority, allows the Pentagon to provide training and gear to foreign forces anywhere in the world. The FAR Mercure 1202 authority allows the Defense Department to offer support to foreign surrogates taking part in irregular warfare aimed at near-peer competitors like China and Russia. The report released recently offers the most complete analysis yet of the legal underpinnings, congressional confusion, and a Pentagon obfuscation surrounding these efforts, and explains how and why the Defense Department has been able to conduct under-the-table conflicts for the last 20 years. The Brennan Center's report underscores the need to shine a light on the defense activities that have been cloaked in secrecy for too long. At the bare minimum, the public and Congress need to know where and why we are sending our service members into harm's way. Representative Sarah Jacobs of California, a member of the House Armed Services Committee, told The Intercept, adding, "I hope this report strengthens the urgency of Congress taking back its war powers, eliminating existing loopholes in security operations programs, and ensuring our strategies match our values, goals, and commitment to our service members." Congress's understanding of U.S. warmaking is often no better than the public record, writes Ebright, adding, "The Departments of Defense diplomatic counterparts in the Department of State also struggle to understand and gain insight into the reach of U.S. hostilities. Where congressional oversight falters, so too does oversight within the executive branch." Ebright's analysis is particularly illuminating in the case of Somalia, where the United States developed two key proxy forces, the Dana Brigade and the Puntland Security Force. The CIA began building the Puntland Security Force in 2002 to battle the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Al-Shabaab and later the State in Somalia, or ISS. The force was transferred to U.S. military control around 2012 and went on to fight alongside U.S. Special Operations Forces for a decade. In Puntland, we built that capability, training them at the tactical level and in how to support themselves and follow a good counterinsurgency strategy against Al-Shabaab. Don Bulldog, the former chief of Special Operations Command Africa and now the Republican candidate for Senate in New Hampshire, told The Intercept in a 2019 interview. Ebright notes that the proxy fighters were largely independent of the Somali government, despite being an elite armed brigade and one of Somalia's most capable special operations units. And their relationship with U.S. forces was long kept secret, with U.S. officials disavowing the presence of military advisors in Somalia until 2014. More troubling, the analysis suggests that for a significant period of time, there was no clear legal basis for U.S. military to fight alongside and direct these forces. The Obama administration designated Al-Shabaab an associated force of Al-Qaeda and thus a legitimate target under 2001 AUMF in 2016. That administration did the same for the ISS in 2014, but ISS has never been publicly identified as an ISIS-associated force by any administration. This means that the Pentagon developed and fought alongside the Puntland Security Force from 2012 and the Donna Brigade from 2011. Under the 127E and 333 Security Cooperation Authorities. Before, the AUMF was judged to authorize hostilities against Al-Shabaab and ISIS, much less ISS. The Department of Defense is unequivocal that it does not treat 333 and 127E as authorizations for use of military force. The reality is not so clear, writes Ebright. After all, U.S. forces have used these authorities to create control and at times engage in combat alongside groups like the Puntland Security Force and Donna Brigade. Over the last 20 years, presidents have consistently claimed broad rights to act in self-defense, not only of U.S. forces, but also for partners like the Puntland Security Force and Donna Brigade, which Ebright notes potentially allows the U.S. to fight remote adversaries in the absence of any congressional authorization. Representative Jacobs said it was difficult to assure the military community in her San Diego district that we are doing everything we can to keep them safe when Congress has such little information, let alone oversight over when, where, and how we are using military force. Attempts to avoid scrutiny from Congress and Congress's own abdication of war powers is central to how we ended up in forever wars, the spike in civilian casualties, and failed strategies that waste taxpayer dollars and the fuel very conflicts they are trying to solve. The report offers suggestions for improving congressional and public oversight, enforcing the balance of war powers within the government, and preventing hostilities unauthorized by Congress. Ebright writes, repealing 333, 127E, and 1202 would return the balance of power to where it stood before the so-called War on Terror, forcing the Pentagon to convince Congress that building foreign proxies abroad is in the United States' national security interest. This is critical given that working by, with, and through foreign surrogates and allies is key to the Pentagon's global vision. According to the Biden administration's recently released National Security Strategy and National Defense Strategy, both of those documents underscore that the DoD views security cooperation as the future of its approach, Ebright told Intercept, adding, meanwhile, on Capitol Hill and in the broader public, we don't have conversations about what this means, to the detriment of voters understanding where we are at war and how this is going to affect military involvement and entrenchment abroad.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
UN's climate change summit, Secretary General Antonio Guterres responded to a UN report released on Sunday by saying that the planet is sending a distress signal.
Greenhouse gas emissions are now on course to rise by 10%. And meanwhile, temperatures are on course to rise by as much as 2.8 degrees with the present policies in place by the end of the century. And that means our planet is on course for reaching tipping points and that will make climate chaos irreversible and forever bake in catastrophic temperature rise. We need to move from tipping points to turning points for hope.
The report had indicated that the past 8 years are said to have had the warmest climates to ever be recorded. The report had also indicated that global temperatures have risen by 1.15 degrees Celsius since the pre-industrial era, catastrophically accelerating rise in sea levels, glacier mass loss, and unprecedented heat waves. World leaders are discussing solutions in Sharm el-Sheikh's Red Sea Resort in Egypt, while the event is hosted by the Egyptian foreign minister, who emphasized on the magnitude of the challenge that now faces the world. The outgoing chair of the talks and British official Alok Sharma mentioned some political reasons as one of the major causes for the impediment of global efforts concerning the environment, specifically the Ukraine war.
War in Ukraine has precipitated multiple global crises: energy and food insecurity, inflationary pressures, and spiraling debt. And these crises have compounded existing climate vulnerabilities and the scarring effects of the pandemic.
But then he went back on the topic of actual climate catastrophes and pointed out the devastating Pakistan and Nigeria floods, as well as unprecedented droughts in Europe, China, and the US. Speaking of, US President Joe Biden is expected to attend the event later in the week. He's usually enthusiastic about climate events. After all, it was Biden who got the U.S. back into the Paris Climate Accord after Trump pulled out of it. But apparently, neither his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping nor Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi are expected to attend, with China and India being among the biggest polluters of the world. Their absence has cast much doubt over the effectiveness of any potential deal planned to cut emissions during the summit. The treaty was adopted in 2015 between 196 parties, including the EU, at the UN Climate Change Conference near Paris. It demands a 50% cut in global emissions until the year of 2030 to keep the temperature rises to well below 2 degrees Celsius, preferably below 1.5. The eventual goal is to reach net zero emissions by the middle of the 21st century. The treaty has determined an aggregate contribution for each country in terms of how much they need to cut down on their emissions. The UK is one of the signatories to the accord, and their share of emissions reductions by 2030 is said to be on the higher end of the spectrum. They are expected to cut down on their emissions by 68% by 2030, compared to UK's emissions in 1990. There have been plans set in motion, but in a document presented by the Secretary of State for Business, Energy and Industrial Energy to the Parliament, the war in Ukraine is mentioned as the reason that prompted the UK Prime Minister to do a, quote, independent review of the government's approach to meeting its net zero 2050 target. That independent review turned into a rather counterproductive decision. The UK has reversed its fracking ban as a result of the energy crisis it is currently going through. Fracking, short for hydraulic fracturing, is a process that involves injecting water, chemicals, and sand into the cracks of the earth at high pressure to widen the cracks and allow for extraction of oil and gas, in the case of the UK, only gas, from shale formations. The ban was introduced in 2019 when an earthquake occurred near Britain's only remaining fracking site. Fracking sites are known to release various forms of toxins and pollutants into the air, including chemicals that can cause severe headaches, asthma symptoms, childhood leukemia, cardiac problems, and even birth defects. Among the 1,000-plus chemicals used in fracking, some are even known to cause cancer. But those were only the negative effects of fracking on humans. For the environment, the vast amount of wastewater and greenhouse gases released, such as methane, will cause irreversible harm. The US isn't hit as hard as the EU as a result of the war in Ukraine, So their arms sales that will in effect prolong the war might even have a net positive effect for the country. But the EU that is hurting the most from the war is getting the short end of the stick. They are scrambling for other means of energy procurement, and the US might just be their last resort. A US that has increased its price of gas for an increasingly desperate Europe in dire need of energy waiting for a difficult winter.
Sirens going off in South Korea. Another salvo of North Korean ballistic missiles fired. This is part of Pyongyang's testing blitz. A new annual record for missile launches was set back in June. And just this week, 23 missiles were launched in a single day, setting a new daily record. U.S. officials have indicated that North Korea is ready to conduct a nuclear test at any time. Let's not forget, these missiles have the ability to reach U.S. soil, specifically California. Meanwhile, Washington and Seoul have conducted their biggest ever Air Force drills. North Korea's firing of intercontinental ballistic missiles and more U.S. war games. A dangerous and volatile concoction, a war scenario which, if it were true, would involve nuclear weapons. That was evident from the U.S. side when the U.S. Air Force deployed the two B-1B long-range heavy bombers on the final day of the military exercises. This was the first time B-1Bs have flown to the Korean Peninsula since December 2017. So why is Pyongyang on the offensive? Even though the missile launches grabbed all the attention, less noticed were developments in the North Korean nuclear doctrine. In September, North Korea updated a 2013 law setting out its nuclear weapons policies and announced that it would respond to attacks against its nuclear command and control systems by launching a nuclear strike automatically and immediately.
The fundamental mission of our nuclear forces is to deter a war. But our nukes can never be confined to the single mission of war deterrent, even at a time when a situation we are not desirous of at all is created on this land.
The U.S. and its allies in this region better be careful. Even an accidental targeting of anything in North Korea could signal a dangerous reaction. And that could spell nuclear Armageddon. North Korea's barrage of missiles is sending the U.S. another message other than military and missile capabilities. North Korea has been under severe U.S. sanctions. For starters, it has sanctioned properties and belongings of the Workers' Party of Korea. Freezing the property of members of the Workers' Party of Korea essentially amounts to stealing from everyday Koreans, as the party's membership stands at 6.5 million people, or a quarter of North Korea's population. Harsh U.S. bilateral and U.N. sanctions have had particularly devastating effects on the North Korean economy. The list of industries directly targeted include the mineral trade, seafood, textiles, and agricultural products. Previous talks between the U.S. and North Korea hinged on the elimination of these sanctions in return for Pyongyang to stop its ballistic nuclear program. But the U.S. was not willing to give any concessions, resulting in a stalemate. Meanwhile, the U.S. believes that China and Russia have the leverage to persuade North Korea not to resume nuclear bomb testing. But why should they do that? Given the Ukraine conflict and how U.S. feels about Russia and U.S.'s appetite for confrontation with China, either militarily or when it comes to trade, this idea seems far-fetched. Perhaps a grand bargain can be reached between U.S., Russia, and China when it comes to North Korea, if the desire is there before it is too late. And as far as U.S. foreign policy goes, it has failed in many respects. When it comes to countries like Iran, North Korea, China, Russia, Syria, well, the list is long. The current U.S. President Joe Biden, like many of his predecessors, has failed to execute a clear diplomatic path to reach solutions, opting instead for provocation and military aggression.
Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan held high-level talks in Tehran following a trilateral meeting with Russian and Azerbaijani leaders on the conflict in the Caucasus region. He was officially received by Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi on Tuesday morning, and the two held talks at the Sadrabad Palace in the capital, Tehran. In addition to a bilateral meeting, the two top executive officials held a meeting of high-level delegations, and after attending the signing ceremony of a cooperation document in the field of energy, they elaborated on the results of their consultations in a joint press conference. The Iranian president stated that Pashinyan's visit to Iran will be a turning point in the development of ties between the two neighboring countries.
Neighborhood policy is one of the policies emphasized by the government, and during this administration we had several meetings with Mr. Pashinyan. In these meetings, especially in this particular meeting, the focus of the negotiations was the development of commercial, economic and security relations between the two countries.
Expressing satisfaction with the growing trends of relations between the two countries, Raisi pointed to the diverse and numerous capacities available in Iran and Armenia, calling for an all-out effort to improve the level of relations and expand bilateral cooperation. The Iranian president pointed to energy cooperation as one of the capacities available to improve the level of relations between the two countries, saying, "The Islamic Republic is ready to expand cooperation in other economic and commercial areas, including in increasing the export of technical and engineering services." Also noting that the Caucasus region is a part of Iran's history, civilization, and culture, Raisi underscored that security and peace in the Caucasus region are very important for Iran. The Iranian president added that negotiations with Pashinyan led to the conclusion that resolving the issues of the region must occur at the hands of officials and authorities of the region, and any interference by foreigners will only create problems rather than solve them. Pashinyan, for his part, appreciated the constructive role of the Islamic Republic in the region and stressed that Iran's efforts have always been aimed at stabilizing and strengthening peace and security in the region. Pashinyan expressed gratitude for the priority given by Raisi's administration to the development of ties with the neighboring countries. The Armenian premier also called for strengthening transit cooperation between the two countries to connect the Black Sea to the Persian Gulf. Iran opened a consulate in the southern Armenian city of Kapan on October 21st, nearly a year after expressing interest in doing so. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian officially inaugurated the consulate. At the opening ceremony, Amir Abdollahian stated that the security of Armenia and the region is Iran's security. He called for the development of north-south transportation corridor through Armenia. He also said Tehran's policies to respect territorial integrity as well as internationally recognized borders. Tehran had previously stated that changes in its borders and transit links with Armenia would be a red line that it would not tolerate being crossed. That's when Turkey and Azerbaijan have been planning to establish a new transport link called the Zangzor Corridor. In case of opening, it will affect Iran-Armenia commerce and could sever a major Iranian transit link with the South Caucasus. Meanwhile, Tehran has not contented itself with only diplomatic messages. The inauguration of the Kapan consulate came after several days of large-scale military exercises by IRGC near Iran's borders with Azerbaijan. The latest simultaneous diplomatic and defensive moves clearly show the Iranian government is ready to defend its national interests in all seriousness.
The United States is under fire for its efforts to influence cyberspace in the country. That's according to a controversial report by The Intercept, which is based on leaked internal memos, emails, and documents of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. The work is primarily done by Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is a DHS sub-agency tasked with protecting critical national infrastructure. The report says the U.S. government has pressured social media platforms to, quote, shape online discourse. The platforms include Twitter and Facebook. The department has justified this pressure on social media platforms by claiming that it wants to fight, quote, disinformation. The plan stemmed from concerns around alleged Russian influence in the 2016 presidential election. It also began to take shape during the 2020 election and over efforts to shape discussions around vaccine policy during the coronavirus pandemic. But how this information is defined by the government has not been clearly articulated. There are now concerns that the inherently subjective nature of what could be classified as disinformation will give officials in the Department of Homeland Security a broad opening to make politically motivated determinations about what constitutes dangerous speech. This is while critics say the extent to which the DHS initiatives affect Americans' daily social feeds is unclear.
We must rethink our approach to cybersecurity. Releasing alerts, deploying incident response teams, sharing best practices are important tools. But as the pace and scale of cyber threats that we face expands, so must our response toolkit. We need sustained investment to modernize and protect our most critical federal systems, as well as state and local governments, suffering under budget constraints and increasingly aggressive ransomware operators.
The CISA's domain has gradually expanded to encompass more subjects it believes amount to critical infrastructure. Some believe CISA's goal is to make platforms more responsive to their demands. There are suggestions circulating inside the agency calling for an expansive role for the agency in, quote, shaping the information ecosystem. There are also calls within the agency to closely monitor social media platforms of all sizes, mainstream media, cable news, hyperpartisan media, talk radio, and other online resources. Critics say there is growing evidence that the legislative and executive branch officials are using social media companies to engage in censorship by surrogate. But the growing authoritarian acts by the DHS and the FBI to monitor Americans have raised alarm among civil rights activists. They say the authoritarian nature of such acts are contrary to the U.S. Privacy Act of 1974, which was legislated after the Watergate scandal that led to President Richard Nixon's resignation. The act prohibits state data collection of Americans exercising their First Amendment rights. Critics also say there are no specific legal constraints on the FBI's use of social media. Recently, Snowden sounded the alarm again, warning that the U.S. was expanding its mass espionage activities both inside the U.S. and outside the country.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Among European countries that are accepting immigrants and war refugees, the United Kingdom has accepted the fewest of all. And, according to human rights groups, the conditions of immigrants and refugees in British camps are not favourable at all, and even their lives are at risk. Recently, British officials signed an agreement with Rwanda to transfer immigrants to this African country instead of settling them in Britain. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has more for us. Recently, Britain's Interior Minister defended the government's treatment of newly arrived migrants after critics blamed her for the wretched conditions endured by thousands of people at the overcrowded centre for asylum seekers. Hundreds of people who crossed the English Channel in small boats have been moved to Manston in Kent, a former airfield in southeast England, after another processing centre was hit with gasoline bombs on Sunday, 30th of October, by an attacker who then killed himself. There already were 3,000 people at this facility, which is intended to hold about half that number. Lucy Morton, who heads the Immigration Services Union, said the number of people at Manston had reached 4,000 and it was catastrophically overcrowded. Britain's Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, defended her department's behaviour, claiming officials were working tirelessly to improve facilities for asylum seekers. But the right-wing politician also referred to small boat crossings as the invasion of our southern coast and said illegal immigration is out of control. Manston in Kent is supposed to be a temporary processing centre where new arrivals spend 24 hours before moving on to longer-term accommodation. But refugee groups say some people have been stuck at this facility for weeks. Chief Inspector of Borders, David Neal, who recently visited Manston, said recently that conditions were wretched. He told lawmakers there had been cases of diphtheria and it's really a dangerous situation. Home Secretary Suella Braverman, who has been in the job for a matter of weeks, is a contentious figure, already under pressure for her use of insecure private email. Her hardline approach has sparked criticism from within the governing Conservative Party, as well as from the opposition. Conservative lawmaker Roger Gale, who represents the Manston area in Parliament, said the situation there was a breach of humane conditions. He accused Braverman of deliberately worsening conditions at Manston by refusing to book hotel rooms for asylum seekers. Suella Braverman denied she had prevented migrants from being moved to hotels. The website of ABC News has more for us. Thousands of refugees, including children, are being held in prison-like conditions at a refugee detention centre in England, and that has drawn concerns about the British government's treatment of asylum seekers. About 1,600 migrants who arrived on British shores after crossing the Channel in small boats are being held in a centre located at the site of a former British Air Force base in a village in Kent in southeast England. Up to 4,000 refugees were staying there at one point recently, with some reportedly detained unlawfully for a month or even more. The overcrowding at the centre reached a breaking point these days after hundreds of people were moved there from another migrant processing centre nearby that was hit with petrol bombs. According to independent government inspectors, families are sleeping on floors in dangerously overcrowded conditions that presented fire and health hazards. They warned of the risk of outbreaks of cases of scabies, diphtheria and other conditions were reported. The conditions at the centre in the village of Manston has put a spotlight on wider problems in Britain's asylum system. Critics say London's incompetence in managing the system goes beyond Manston. The opposition Labour Party has said only 4% of asylum claims from small boat arrivals were processed last year, meaning more than 100,000 people are in limbo, waiting for their applications for protection to be considered. Critics, including Labour, have blamed Britain's Home Secretary Suella Braverman's hardline stance against unauthorised immigration for aggravating the problems within the asylum system. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has said the migrant crisis is a serious and escalating problem. Rishi Sunak acknowledged that not enough asylum claims are being processed, but claimed his Conservative government was getting a grip on the situation. Britain's Guardian newspaper has more for us. UK police have confirmed a man threw petrol bombs attached with fireworks at a new Border Force immigration centre in Dover, in Kent, adding the suspect was found deceased nearby. The attacker, a white man in blue and white shirt, drove up to the centre in a white sports utility vehicle. According to a photographer for the Reuters news agency, he threw three petrol bombs, one of which did not go off. Police said the suspect was identified and located at a nearby petrol station where he was confirmed dead. One minor injury was reported in the incident. A photograph of the incident showed a man releasing a plastic bottle taped to a lit firework as he drove away. Police added the suspected attacker had been identified and located, confirming reports that the suspect had died while saying inquiries were ongoing. The apparent attack occurred at an immigration centre compound on the Dover Harbour side in Kent. The compound is where people who have crossed the channel in small boats are taken by Border Force officials. It came after almost 1,000 people arrived in the United Kingdom after crossing the channel on Saturday, 29th of October. The incident has prompted a call for politicians to stop using anti-immigration rhetoric. Claire Mosley, the founder of the campaign Care for Calais, said she was concerned recent rhetoric by ministers may have been a factor in the attack. Claire Mosley said, "We're seeing an escalation in hate on social media and threats against our volunteers. The rhetoric from this government's ministers is shocking and divisive."
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith through action. Sunday, the 5th of Ramadan, 1394, the 22nd of September, 1974. Now, Imam Zainul Abidin wants to defend the following thesis, that humbling oneself before Allah, weeping to Allah, worshipping and supplicating to Allah is to polish the soul, to make oneself more determined, to make oneself more reliant on Allah, and not to slacken. He wants to defend this thesis, but this Shia layperson also has an erroneous understanding that he wants to correct. What would you say? Look at the Imam's words. Let us not speak of my father, my mother, and my grandfather. Paradise is for the obedient. This is the thesis of Shia Islam with regard to faith and actions. Why am I placing so much emphasis on this issue? Because for many years, centuries even, the idea has been put into the minds of Muslims that it is not necessary to do anything in order to be a Muslim. They have been told that all you need to be a believer is a pure heart. You don't need to do anything else. And we have helped our enemies foster this idea in our minds through our own indolence and laziness.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We think that we are going to paradise and it will be given to us for the slightest thing. This false notion has been so successful in spreading because people are ignorant and they want to believe this is true. They had no other motive in spreading this idea save that they were ignorant. In fact, it was only a short time after the Prophet that this idea came into existence and began to spread. In the early centuries of Islam, one day people saw that Muawiyah was advising his followers that when he died, there were two packages that they should bring and bury with him in his grave. They asked, "What are these things?" He He tells them that one of the packages contains a piece of the Prophet's clothes. As for the other, well, one day the Prophet was trimming his hair or nails, and some clippings fell on the ground, which Muawiyah said to his followers, "Put these in my grave so that Allah forgives me." Do you see, even Muawiyah hoped for the Prophet's intercession and tried to obtain it. But how did he do this? By taking some hair or nail clippings from the Prophet. Bravo! He was willing to strive to the extent that it was easy, to the extent that it was no cost to him. He will listen to the Quran, he will respect the Quran, but only to the extent that it is useful for him.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
According to economists' forecasts, the American economic recession is certain within the next 12 months. Analysts say US President Joe Biden has not been able to fulfill his promises and the economic conditions of the American people have worsened during his presidency. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of NBC News has more for us. A new opinion poll shows 43% of the American public say their family's financial situation is worse than 2 years ago, as inflation has made it harder for people to make ends meet. The new survey released on Sunday, 6th of November, finds that the share has doubled since President Joe Biden took office last year on 20th of January, replacing Donald Trump. 43% of those who took part in the survey said their family's financial situation has worsened, but 39% said it has remained the same in the past 2 years, while 18% claimed it is better now. According to exit polling, only about 20% of voters said their financial situation had worsened at the time of the 2020 presidential election, compared to 4 years earlier when Donald Trump was elected. In what's being called a disaster for the ruling Democratic Party, inflation reached a 40-year high in the final official reading. A report published recently on inflation showed prices in the United States are rising more than expected. The data is even worse than it appears because the government excludes food and petrol from the official inflation rate. The record high inflation is being driven by increases in other necessities such as lodging, medical care, and mass transportation. President Biden said in a statement on Friday, 4th of November, that inflation is a top economic challenge and claimed that he has a plan to bring down prices by lowering healthcare costs and energy costs. Joe Biden claimed the Republican plan is very different. They want to increase prescription drug costs, health insurance costs, and energy costs, while giving more tax breaks to big corporations and the very wealthy. Here's the deal: cutting corporate taxes and allowing big pharma to raise prices again is the Republican inflation plan, and it's a disaster. With prices rising 8.2% and wages increasing just 4.9%, economists say the average American effectively is losing almost an entire day's pay, and that's using the official inflation rate. Even though almost every economic indicator is negative, the nation's bankers seem intent on restricting borrowing just when businesses are pulling back new job offers in record numbers, and credit card debt is at a record high. The situation has already deteriorated into liberalism's theoretically unsolvable dilemma: stagflation, which is recession plus inflation. Website Politico has more for us. According to a new Morning Consult poll, nearly two-thirds of registered voters believe the U.S. economy is currently in a recession. About 65% of respondents indicated they believe the economy is already in a recession, compared to 22% who said the opposite. 14% didn't know or had no opinion. Republicans were more likely to consider the economy to be in a recession, with 81% saying so, compared to 63% of independents and 51% of Democrats. Concerns about an economic slowdown have grown as the U.S. Federal Reserve continues aggressively hiking interest rates, which increases borrowing costs to lower inflation by cooling off demand. Analysts and economists are confident the U.S. Federal Reserve will announce a hike in its baseline interest rate in its interest rate range of another 0.75 percentage point, which would mark the fourth consecutive increase at the aggressive pace. U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell has indicated the central bank will keep increasing interest rates until inflation shows clear signs of falling. But progressive Democrats are increasingly ripping Jerome Powell for risking job losses as a result of the moves. The hikes already have caused rising mortgage rates and a steep decline in home sales. Wage growth has slowed down and businesses have pulled back on long-term investments that could drive future growth. But although inflation has eased from a 40-year high reached earlier this year, price gains remain at elevated levels. The latest consumer price index, the CPI, indicates prices rose 0.4% in the month of September, marking the second straight month of accelerating inflation. Annual inflation dropped slightly to 8.2%. Meanwhile, gross domestic product or GDP declined in the first two quarters of this year, sparking debate over whether the data signified the economy was technically in a recession. President Joe Biden suggested last month the possibility of a slight recession, while indicating he didn't believe there would be one at all, and the White House has regularly touted strong employment numbers and manufacturing growth to reject talk of such a downturn. The British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. Millions of Americans are currently working two or more jobs in order to make ends meet, as global inflation and corporations jacking up prices have sent prices of food, gas, housing, health insurance, and other necessities soaring in the past year. According to data from the U.S. Census, more Americans have been working two or more jobs over the past few decades, with women more likely than men to have multiple jobs and multiple job holders, most prevalent among low-wage workers. Laura Richwine of Omaha, Nebraska, works two jobs, one in fraud prevention and the other doing administrative work, and had previously been working three jobs to keep up with hefty medical bills she'd been facing since being hit by a car in 2014. Based on data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, more than 400,000 Americans work two full-time jobs. In September of 2022, 4.9% of more than 164 million U.S. workers held two or more jobs over 7.7 million workers. Though U.S. Census data estimates these rates and numbers to be much higher at 7.8% in the most recent year where data is available, 2018, about 13 million workers, while BLS data at the time estimated 5% of the workforce holding multiple jobs. Both data sets are considered an underestimate of the number of multiple job holders in the United States labor market due to considerations on what is defined as a multiple job holder and a lack of data on self-employment, such as gig workers. An annual survey sponsored by the Federal Reserve Board estimated an even higher number of workers in multiple jobs at 16.4% in 2019, about 26.5 million workers in the United States.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
U.S. President Joe Biden recounted his trips to Afghanistan in a recent speech to war veterans, including one in 2008 in which he was stranded in snow. In his remarks, he repeatedly disparaged Afghanistan as a godforsaken place. The Taliban say his words are out of frustration.
We don't know on what basis they've stated such a thing, but Afghans continue to live their normal lives. There is no need for the U.S. cooperation and help. Such statements are made out of frustration and envy. In any case, God willing, Afghans live their normal lives and build their country themselves.
People here say nearly two decades of U.S. presence in Afghanistan didn't have any positive impacts on their lives. They say the American forces committed countless war crimes and destroyed basic infrastructure in many areas.
The U.S. has not served any country it has entered. The U.S. considers its own interests wherever it goes. There is no improvement in the lives of Afghans, as you see, and people are poor.
The U.S. was in Afghanistan for 20 years, and now Biden says Afghanistan is a godforsaken country. The main factor to that is the Americans themselves who created disorder in this country.
The U.S. ended its occupation of Afghanistan in August 2021, but shortly after that, the Biden administration imposed sanctions on the country and froze billions of dollars worth of assets belonging to Afghanistan, leaving the country in a difficult economic situation. People say the ongoing war in Afghanistan is an economic one. Many are striving to survive while billions of dollars of their assets are frozen by the U.S. Abdullah Hamirzad, Kabul.
It is blatantly obvious that Brussels is losing its energy war with Moscow as prices across the 19-country eurozone continue to skyrocket. Washington is benefiting by selling gas to the EU at a high price. Eurozone finance ministers met on Monday to assess the crisis.
We are focusing now also within the European Commission, within the General Council, how we can, and then also with the ministers of energy that are focusing on how we can reduce that cost in the near future.
The poorest are feeling the pain most. eye-watering amounts have been spent to try and compensate.
Euro area governments have so far collectively spent about 1.25% on energy supports for the year, so about 200 billion euro.
Of course, it's all linked to the EU's attempts to isolate Russia over the war in Ukraine. It's costing EU taxpayers billions of euro to house Ukrainian refugees, supply weapons to the Ukrainian army, and fund the government in Kiev. Ordinary workers will have to pay for it, but the eurozone economy is beginning to flatline.
Inflation continues to be high, even surprisingly high for both Europe and the United States. Sentiment indicators are very low, indicating a risk of recession.
It appears the European Union is now in damage control mode.
I am telling that we can work, should work, to avoid that this is a prolonged period of recession.
Peace activists are calling on the EU to mediate between Russia and Ukraine, but those calls appear to be falling on deaf ears. Many people are now nervously wondering, is there an unemployment catastrophe looming in the eurozone? Whether they are being overly pessimistic or merely realistic, there's no doubt a growing number of economists are suggesting the eurozone is heading for a deep, prolonged recession. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A string of humanitarian groups have slammed the Italian government for breaking international law after pushing back over 200 asylum seekers who were trying to reach a safe port in Italy. Two rescue vessels, the Humanity One and the Gio Barents, had docked in Sicily on Sunday, carrying hundreds of asylum seekers. The most vulnerable ones, women, children and ill people, were allowed to disembark. But 35 men on the Humanity One and another 215 on the Gio Barents were told to stay on board. That was made possible by the Italian authorities hastily adopting a new decree which has introduced a selective approach in deciding to disembark from the rescue boats. Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni had put migration flows in the spotlight during her first trip to Brussels last week, when she asked the EU to help handle asylum seekers' arrivals on Italian coasts.
Our priorities are shifting. Italy's approach to migration will now be to defend its national borders. The matter is highly sensitive, but many EU leaders have agreed with me on this issue.
The Humanity One said it would launch legal action against the Italian government, claiming Rome's decision to not let all the asylum seekers disembark violates European law and the Geneva Refugee Convention. Meanwhile, two other boats run by non-governmental organizations remain at sea, with no ports willing to accept them. In 2017, the Italian government signed an EU-sponsored agreement with the Libyan government. The deal, which is still in place, provides that Italy and the EU help the Libyan Coast Guard enhance its maritime surveillance capacity by providing financial support and technical assets. In practical terms, under the deal, every asylum seeker intercepted at sea ends up in a Libyan detention center where torture, sexual violence and abuse are practiced.
The European member state and its citizens have been manipulated by few political heads. They do not know the facts, what is happening on the Mediterranean, what are the causes why people are forced to migrate. So when we tell this story, when we try to approach, when we try to unveil these realities, what is happening in the concentration camp in Libya, people will wake up.
Since the start of the year, about 180,000 asylum seekers have reached the EU on boats, up almost 90% compared to the year before. We are in the middle of the biggest mass migration in Europe since the end of World War II, and as distasteful as it may sound, that's also a huge business opportunity. An increasing number of people believe that refugee flows